cortisone injection in his hip and made sure he took 50 milligrams of topiramate to forestall further migraines. Nelly gets in the passenger seat, and as Eric drives off, he looks in the rearview mirror and sees Yuna sit down on the swing seat again. "Shall I drive you home?" Eric asks. "Didn't you say she lived in Jönköping?" "Apparently she moved to Eskilstuna 5 years ago."
"That's about an hour away, isn't it?"
"Yes."
"Martin said he'd be working late today," says Nelly. "So I won't have to sit in the house alone with all those windows. I keep getting the feeling that someone's spying on me. It's just because of you talking about this murderer, I know that. But still..."
"Is someone watching you then?"
"No," she laughs. "I'm just scared of the dark."
They head down Enskedevägen towards Södertälje and sit in silence as they drive past a long, grey, noise-proof fence.
"You said you were sure the priest was guilty," Nelly says, looking at him.
"He said so himself. He said he'd killed Rebecca. But after hypnosis, he suddenly remembered."
"Remembered what, though?"
"Suddenly remembered a woman who could confirm his alibi?" she asks skeptically. "At first he remembered telling me about the alibi."
"Shit," she says. "What happened? Did he get angry?"
"Yes. My chest feels a bit painful."
"Did you have a fight? Can I see?"
She tries to pull his shirt up, and he holds the wheel with his left hand as he fends her off with the right. "We'll end up in the ditch," he laughs. She loosens her seatbelt and turns in her seat so she can look at him.
"But are you in pain?"
she asks, undoing his buttons.
"God, you're black and blue. What the hell did he do? That must really hurt."
She leans over and kisses Eric's chest, kisses his neck, and then quickly on the mouth before he turns his face away.
"Sorry," she says.
"I can't, Nelly."
"I know. I didn't mean... It's just that I sometimes think about that time we slept together."
"We were incredibly drunk," Eric reminds her.
"I don't regret a thing," she says gently, with her face right next to his.
"Nor do I," he replies, tucking his shirt back in his trousers with one hand. They drive along the E20 for a while in silence. A few emergency vehicles race past with their sirens blaring. Nelly picks up her handbag, folds down the sun visor to use the mirror, and touches up her lipstick.
"We could do it again, if we wanted to," she suddenly says.
"That would never work."
"No, I know. I say things I don't mean. It was just a fantasy about how different everything could be in another universe," Nelly says.
"All the lives we haven't lived," Eric says quietly.
"Thinking like that is bound to be a sign of getting older," she smiles.
"The tiniest choice closes 1,000 doors and opens 1,000 more," Eric says. "I lied about an alibi, and 9 years later the lie catches up with me, and I risk..."
"Yes, but you're an idiot,"
Nelly interrupts, leaning back.
"I don't believe in that alibi. But I mean, if this woman confirms it, then I ought to report you."
He gives her a sideways glance. "If you want to report me, go ahead," he says.
"Rocky's been locked up for 9 years. Locked up and medicated, and..."
"Please, Nelly," Eric interrupts. "I'm sorry, but I can't handle this conversation. I'm not going to ask you for anything. You can do whatever you like, whatever you think is the right thing to do."
"Then I'll report you," she says firmly.
"I don't care," he mumbles.
"But it would be a lot easier if you weren't so sweet when you get angry," she smiles.
"I dare say I need therapy,"
Eric sighs. You need medication, she says, and pulls a pack of Mogadon from her bag. She presses out two capsules, takes one, and gives Eric the other. He murmurs, cheers, tips his head back, and swallows. Chapter 65. When Eric parks the car beside the school where Olivia Turibi works as a teacher, Nelly hesitates with her hand on the door handle. Do you want me to come? She asks. Say what you think.
I don't know. No. Maybe it would be better if you wait here.
So you can use your charm? She smiles.
Exactly.
I'll stay here with your dream woman, she says, pointing at the little monkey in the pink skirt hanging from the ignition key. Eric walks across the playground, asks a caretaker for Olivia Turibi, and he points her out. Olivia is in her 50s, a thin woman with a pale, worn face. She's standing with her arms folded, watching the children on the climbing frame. Now and then, one of them calls out to her or runs over, wanting help with something.
Olivia, my name's Eric Maria Bark, and I'm a doctor, Eric says, handing her his card.
A doctor? She repeats, putting the card in her pocket.
I need to talk to you about Rocky Shirklund.
Her thin face hardens for a moment, then reverts to neutral. The police again? She says simply.
I've spoken to Rocky Shirklund, and he...
I've already said I don't know anyone of that name, Olivia interrupts.
I know, Eric says patiently, but he talked about you.
I've got no idea how he managed to get hold of my name.
She looks at some children with skipping ropes round their necks, playing horses, and hurries over and puts the ropes round their waists instead.
I'm supposed to have finished work, really, she says when she returns to Eric.
Just give me a few minutes.
Sorry, I have to get home and prepare appraisals for 22 children, she says, and starts to walk off towards the school building.
I believe Rocky Shirklund was convicted of a murder he didn't commit, Eric says, hurrying after her.
I'm sorry to hear that, but
he was a priest, but he was also addicted to heroin at the same time. He exploited the people around him.
She stops in the shade in front of the steps and turns towards Eric. He was utterly ruthless, she says in a toneless voice.
So I understand, Eric replies. But he still doesn't deserve to be convicted of a murder he didn't commit. Olivia's graying hair falls over her forehead, and she blows it away.
Will anything bad happen to me if I lied to the police before?
Only if you lied under oath in a court.
Of course, she says,
and her thin mouth quivers nervously. They sit on the steps. Olivia looks down at her trainers, picks something off her jeans, and clears her throat.
I was a different person then. And I don't want to get mixed up in anything, she says quietly. But it's true. I did know him back then.
He says you can give him an alibi.
I can, she admits, and swallows hard.
Are you sure?
She nods. Her chin starts to tremble, and she looks down again.
9 years have passed, Eric says.
She tries to swallow the lump in her throat, rubs her top lip, then looks up with shiny eyes and swallows hard once more. We were in the rectory in Rüninge. That's where he lived, she says in an uneven voice.
We are talking about the evening of April 15th, Eric reminds her.
Yes, she replies, and quickly brushes some tears from her cheeks.
How can you remember that?
Her mouth starts to quiver, and she bites her bottom lip to pull herself together before she answers. We were on a bender together, she says in a whisper. We started on the Friday, and
It was at its worst on Sunday night.
You're sure about the dates?
She nods and loses control of her voice.
My little boy died in his cot on the 15th. I only found him the next day. It was sudden infant death syndrome. That was medically proven. It wasn't my fault. But if he'd been with me, then it might not have happened.
I'm sorry to...
Oh, God,
she sobs and gets to her feet. Olivia turns away from the playground, wraps her arms tightly around herself, and forces herself to be quiet to stop her grief pouring out. Eric tries to give her a handkerchief, but she doesn't see it. She takes a few trembling breaths and wipes her tears away.
For years after that, I just wanted to die, she says, swallowing hard again. But I've never touched drugs since. I haven't had sex with anyone. I must never get pregnant again. I don't have the right. He took everything with him. I hate him for getting me to try heroin. I hate him for everything.
They are interrupted by a ball rolling under the bench. A child comes running over to fetch it, and Eric hands Olivia his handkerchief.
Don't worry, Marcus,
she says warmly to the little boy, who's standing looking at her with the ball under his arm.
I just need to blow my nose.
The child nods and runs off with the ball. Eric thinks about Rocky's erratic memory. At some moments during his years at Karsuden, he must have known that he had been wrongly convicted because of Eric's betrayal.
Olivia, Eric says quietly, I appreciate that this isn't easy, but are you prepared to swear on oath that you were with Rocky when the murder took place?
Yes,
she says, looking him in the eye. Eric thanks her and at that moment notices Nelly standing behind the climbing frame, watching them. He starts to walk back and wonders if she's going to report him when she finds out. Maybe he himself could file a report about a patient suffering harm while receiving treatment before she does. Chapter 66. Before the paint dries completely, Eric and Madeleine carefully pull off the masking tape from the skirting boards and around the door and window, fold up the stiff protective paper, and pull the plastic off the furniture that they stacked in the middle of the room. Although he's taken two tranquilizers, he still feels overwhelmed with remorse whenever he thinks about the priest who has been locked up for longer than Madeleine has been alive, because of his lie. They carry on cleaning until the pizza delivery guy rings the bell. Madeleine holds Eric's hand as they go out into the hall to open the door.
How does it look?
Jackie asks when they come into the kitchen.
Great,
Madeleine says, looking up at Eric. Outside in the street, rain is falling through the thin sunlight, and the day feels pleasantly slow, like something from childhood. Eric cuts up the pizza and puts it on their plates.
Robots eat pizza,
Madeleine says happily. Her face is totally relaxed. She's so relieved that she starts to sing a song from the Disney film Frozen, even though Jackie tries to tell her several times that she shouldn't sing at the dinner table.
Clever robot,
Madeleine keeps saying to Eric.
But what if he starts to get rusty?
Jackie smiles as she feels something against her foot.
He won't,
the little girl says.
Maddie, what's this?
She asks, carefully shaking a blister pack of morphine mierda that must have fallen out of Eric's jacket as it hung over the back of the chair.
That's mine, he says. It's just some headache pills.
He takes the pills from her hand and puts them in his pocket.
Eric, Jackie says, can I ask you for a favor? Maddie's got a match on Wednesday, and I'm playing at the evening service in Hirselby Church. I don't like to ask, it feels wrong, but Rosita, who usually brings Maddie home, has been ill all week.
You'd like me to pick her up?
I can walk on my own, Mum. It's only at Östermalm Sports Club, Madeline says quickly.
You're certainly not walking on your own, Jackie snaps.
I'll pick her up, Eric says.
It's actually a lethal road, Jackie says seriously.
Leidingavegen and Valhallavegen are completely mad, Eric agrees.
She's got her own key, and you don't have to stay if you can't. I'll be back by 8.
I might have time to watch the match, Eric says hopefully to Madeline.
Eric, I'm incredibly grateful, and I promise I won't ask again.
Don't say that. I'm only too happy to help.
Jackie whispers a silent thank you to him, and he gets up to clear the table just as his mobile buzzes in his shirt pocket. It's Kasilas from Karsuden District Hospital. After his meeting with Olivia Turibi, Eric called him to discuss the chances of Rocky Shetland being allowed on excursions outside the hospital and beginning his rehabilitation.
I've spoken to the administrative court today, Kasilas tells him, and you won't be surprised to hear that you and I are in complete agreement.
That's great, Eric says.
The big problem is that Rocky refuses to sign. He says he murdered a woman and that he doesn't deserve to be free.
I can talk to him, Eric volunteers quickly.
It's just that there's not much time if it's going to be considered at the next quarterly meeting.
1.5 hours later, Eric passes through the security doors of Section D4, is shown through the corridor and out into the fenced exercise yard. The patients in Rocky's section have all committed serious violent crimes under the influence of severe mental disorders, but most of them are doing relatively well with their medication and are no longer considered particularly dangerous. On the other side of the high fence is a low hedge. The bushes press against the fence as if they wanted to get inside the yard. Rocky Shetland squints at him in the broken sunshine as he approaches along the path.
No nice pills today, doctor?
No.
A man shouts something at Rocky from a distance, but Rocky ignores him.
I've spoken to Olivia Turibi, Eric begins.
Who's she?
We talked about her last time, and she confirms your alibi.
My alibi for what?
For the murder of Rebecca Hanson.
Good.
Rocky smiles and runs his huge hand through his steel-gray hair.
She was addicted to heroin at the time, and I don't think her evidence would have affected the verdict against you, but I wanted you to know that all the evidence suggests that you're innocent.
You mean this is really happening?
He says skeptically.
Yes. An alibi,
Rocky repeats to himself. Olivia Turibi is living a different life these days, and she's sure of what she says. You were together at the time of the murder.
Rocky focuses his eyes on Eric's.
So I didn't murder Rebecca Hanson, he says quietly.
I don't think so, Eric replies, without looking away.
How sure is she?
Rocky asks, and his jaw muscles tense.
She knows because you were high on the night of the murder, and it was the same night her son died of sudden infant death syndrome.
Rocky nods and stares straight up at the white sky.
And that matches the register of deaths, Eric concludes.
So all this crap has been for nothing, Rocky says, taking a crumpled pack of cigarettes from his pocket.
She was a drug addict, and I don't think the court would have believed her testimony at the time, Eric repeats.
I might still have ended up here, but I'd have felt completely different if I'd known.
The air currents between the buildings are picking up dust and loose particles in the sunlit park. The man who shouted is walking towards them across the yard. Eric looks at his face, swollen with medication, at the clumsy tattoos on his cheeks and forehead as he passes them, whispering to himself. It's time for you to give your consent to the application for permission to leave the hospital.
Maybe.
What are you going to do when you get out? Eric asks.
What do you think?
Rocky smiles, pulling a half-smoked cigarette from the packet.
I don't know, Eric says. I'm going to fall to my knees and thank God, he says sarcastically.
You'll be free, but your alibi also means something else that I need to talk to you about.
Nice.
The reason why I've been coming here is that the police are hunting a serial killer whose methods are reminiscent of what Rebecca Hanson was subjected to.
Say that again?
A gentle breeze fills an empty plastic bag with air and sends it tumbling across the exercise yard as if it were unfettered by time itself. Chapter 67. Rocky clenches his teeth and leans back against the fence so that the light shining through the links changes. The police are hunting a serial killer, Eric repeats, and the murders are reminiscent of that of Rebecca Hanson.
I'm trying to take in the fact that I'm innocent, Rocky says in a loud voice. I'm trying to understand that I haven't killed another person.
I can appreciate that.
I've been living with a fucking killer for 9 years now,
he concludes, pointing to his own heart.
Rocky,
the guard calls as he approaches.
Isn't a person allowed to be happy?
What's going on?
The guard asks, stopping in front of them.
Are you going back inside?
Do you know I've been wrongly convicted?
He says.
Then we're back to 100% innocent here at Karsuddin,
the guard says, and goes in. Rocky watches him with a smile and puts his packet of cigarettes in his pocket.
Tell me why I should try to help the police, he says, cupping his hands around a match.
Innocent people are dying.
That's debatable, he mutters.
The real murderer was responsible for you ending up in here, Eric says. You understand? He did this to you, no one else. Rocky inhales the smoke and wipes the corners of his mouth with his big nicotine-stained thumb. Eric looks at his worn face and deep-set eyes.
You could end up getting a complete pardon in the appeal court, Eric says tentatively, and maybe get your job as a priest back.
Rocky smokes for a while, then flicks the cigarette towards another patient who thanks him and picks it up off the ground.
What could I do for the police? He asks.
You might be a witness. It's possible that you knew the perpetrator, Eric goes on. From what you've said, it sounds like he could be a colleague of yours.
How do you mean?
You've spoken about a preacher, Eric says, watching Rocky closely. An unclean preacher who could have been a heroin addict, just like you. The priest seems lost in the view of the trees. A prison service van is visible in the distance, driving along the road between the tree trunks.
I don't remember that, Rocky says slowly.
You seemed frightened of him.
The only people you're frightened of are the dealers. Some are completely crazy. I know there was one whose mouth was full of gold teeth. I remember him because he loved the fact that I was a priest. So I always had to do loads of crap. Money wasn't enough. He wanted me on my knees, denying the existence of God before he would let me buy any gear. That sort of thing.
What was his name? Rocky shakes his head and shrugs.
It's gone, he says in a low voice. Could the preacher have been the name you gave the dealer? No idea. But I used to feel like I was being stalked in those days. Presumably, it was withdrawal. But, you know, once when I was supposed to pick up some new liturgical vestments, it was morning, and the light was coming in through the christening window. There were 1,000 colors on the altar rail and along the aisle.
Rocky falls silent and just stands there with his arms hanging by his sides. What happened?
What?
You were talking about the church.
Yes. The vestments had been dumped in front of the side altar. Someone had pissed on them. It had run all over the floor, in the cracks around the flagstones.
It sounds like you had an enemy, Eric says.
I know I thought people were creeping around outside the rectory at night. I used to turn the lights off, but I never saw anyone. But once I did find big tracks in the snow outside the bedroom window.
But did you have an enemy who...
What do you think? Rocky asks impatiently. I knew 1,000 idiots, and practically all of them would have killed their own brothers and sisters for a couple of raps. And I'd smuggled a load of amphetamines from Vilnius and was waiting for the money.
Yes, but this is a serial killer, Eric persists. The motive isn't money or drugs. Rocky's pale green eyes stare at him.
I might have met the murderer, like you say. But how am I supposed to know? You're not telling me anything. Give me a detail. It might trigger my memory.
I'm not involved in the investigation.
But you know more than I do, Rocky says.
I know that one of the victims was called Susanna Kern. Before she got married, she was Susanna Eriksson.
I don't remember anyone of that name, the priest replies.
She was stabbed in the chest, neck, and face.
Like they said I'd done to Rebecca,
Rocky says. And the body was arranged so that her hand was covering her ear, Eric goes on.
Is it the same with the others?
I don't know.
Well, I can hardly help unless I know more, he says. My memory has to have something to latch onto.
I understand, but I don't...
What were the other victims' names?
I don't have access to the preliminary investigation, Eric concludes.
So what the hell are you doing here, then?
Rocky roars and marches off across the grass. Chapter 68. It's already 5 o'clock in the afternoon as Eric walks down the corridor of the psychology clinic with a cup of coffee in his hand. He can see a tall figure standing quite still against the ribbed glass of the stairwell. As he pulls out his keys and stops outside his door, he realizes that it's his former patient, Nestor.
Are you waiting for me? Eric asks, walking over to him.
Thanks for the lift.
You've already thanked me.
The thin hand moving across his chest stops, as grey as silk.
I just wanted to say that I'm thinking of getting another dog, he said in a low voice.
That's great, but you know you don't have to tell me.
I know, Nestor replies, blushing slightly. But I was here anyway, checking Mother's grave, so...
Was that okay?
Would it be possible to bury her any deeper, do you think?
He falls silent and takes a step back when Nelly approaches down the corridor.
She gives Eric a cheery wave, but when she sees he's busy, she stops outside her own office and starts looking for her keys in her shiny bag.
"We can make an appointment for you to come and talk, if you like," Eric says, glancing at his door.
"There's no need. It's just," Nestor says quickly, "a dog is a big step for me, so..."
"You're better now, so you can do whatever you like.
I know how I was when I came to you. You can ask me for anything, Eric."
"Thanks."
"You need to get on," Nestor says.
"Yes."
"I walked and walked, and suddenly it came to me," Nestor says with unexpected intensity in his voice. "I bent down and..."
"No riddles now," Eric interrupts.
"No, sorry,"
the tall man says and walks off. Eric checks his watch. He's only got a few minutes before he's due to meet Margot Silverman, but he might just have time for a word with Nelly before then. He goes over to her room and knocks on the open door. Nelly's already sitting at her computer, and for once she's got her reading glasses on. She's wearing a white tie-neck blouse with black spots and a tight burgundy skirt. "What did Nestor want?" she asks, without looking up from the screen.
"He's going to get a dog and wanted to talk about it."
"Maybe you need to tell him about the umbilical cord and the pair of scissors."
"He's sweet," Eric says.
"I'm not so sure," Nelly says.
Eric can't help smiling as he walks over to the window and tells her that her idea for restructuring the crisis groups is already working well.
"Yes, it feels pretty good," she says, taking her glasses off.
"I've got a meeting with the police, but..."
she smiles. "It's a shame I haven't got time to join you."
"Nelly, I just wanted to say that you're right," Eric says. "There are always problems once you start telling lies."
"Can we do this later?" she asks.
"It's just... I want you to know that I'm going to do all I can to get Rocky out of Karsuden as soon as possible. And
hang on," she interrupts. "I don't want you to be upset, but I've spoken to Martin, and you know he likes you, he really does. But he says I have to report you to both the police and the healthcare inspectorate."
"Good," he says, and starts walking towards the door. He leaves the room and sees that Margot Silverman and her colleague are waiting outside his door. They say hello and follow him to the floor below. The meeting room has a glass wall facing the corridor and new chairs that smell of plastic. Eric opens the window to let some air in and invites them to sit down. Margot fills a mug from the water dispenser, drinks, then refills it.
"Well, of course you know that Olivia Tureby has changed her mind," he begins.
"Rocky remembers a 9-year-old alibi, but not a single damn thing we can actually use," Margot says, sitting down heavily.
"You wanted me to ask him about an accomplice, only we've ended up with the opposite. Rocky was wrongly convicted, and what if he's just faking his memory loss?" she says.
"He isn't, but he's involved. He's mixed up in this somehow."
"If I could just continue," Eric says, running his hand over the surface of the table. "The real murderer was never caught and has suddenly started killing again. Both in conversation and under hypnosis, Rocky keeps coming back to a preacher who..."
"A priest?" Adam says.
"A preacher who there's probably good reason to take seriously in light of the alibi."
"But you've got no name, no location.
It takes time to find a way through the chaos." "But under hypnosis, he described how the preacher killed a woman
by chopping her arm off. The problem is that I'm not completely sure how much of that is nightmares and how much genuine memories.
But you believe there's some truth in this? Adam asks, leaning forward.
He's mentioned the preacher several times, even when he's not hypnotized.
But nothing about the murder?
Rocky says he's prepared to help the police if he can. At least he was prepared to do so before, even if it was actually a fairly absurd situation. I'm trying to help him remember, but I don't know anything.
Everything is strictly confidential, Margot explains. If you want his help, Eric says, then you're going to have to go and see him and give him some details, names, locations, things that could trigger the process of remembering.
It's probably best if you carry on talking to him, she says.
I can do that, but...
What do you need to make progress? Margot says.
That's your decision. We're still trying to hold the media at bay, even if our press officer doesn't think that's sustainable anymore, Adam says.
It's just that we have no idea how the serial killer will react to a load of publicity, Margot says.
He might simply vanish.
Or so we need to move fast, Adam says.
You can have some pictures of the victims to show Rocky, she says. We've done a perpetrator profile, and I can tell you about his modus operandi and specific characteristics.
Will you be including any fake information?
Of course, she says.
As long as I know, Eric says.
Margot takes a deep breath, then begins to describe the killer's methods and choice of victim.
So far, it's been women who are alone in their homes, she says quietly.
First, he films them through a window. Then he plans his attack. And then, once he's decided to murder them,
he sends the video to us, Adam says in a heavy voice. The killer finds his murder weapon at the scene and always leaves it behind.
He leans over and takes three photographs out of his case and puts them on the table, picture side down.
As soon as you've shown these to Rocky, we need you to destroy them.
Eric looks at the back of the pictures, which are inscribed with the names of the victims. Maria Carlson, Susanna Kern, Sandra Lundgren.
Sandra Lundgren?
Eric says, turning the picture over and gasping.
What is it? Margot asks.
She's a patient of ours.
God, she's dead?
You knew her? Chapter 69. Eric's mouth is completely dry as he sits in the meeting room and stares at the large color photograph. It's a recent picture, and he can see that Sandra is struggling to look happy. The light is reflecting off her glasses, but her green eyes are clearly visible. Her dark blonde hair is slightly longer, settling on her shoulders.
God, he repeats.
She was in a car accident. Her boyfriend was killed, and we were a bit late starting her treatment. She was very badly depressed. Survivor's guilt. Kept having panic attacks.
She was your patient? Margot says slowly.
To start with, but one of my colleagues took over.
Why?
He forces himself to tear his eyes from Sandra Lundgren's symmetrical face and looks up at Margot again.
That often happens, he tries to explain. It's to do with different stages of the treatment.
He turns over the next photograph, and his heart starts beating faster when he sees Maria Carlson. He recognizes her, too. Before he met Jackie, he had a brief fling with Maria. She used to go to the same gym as him. They started walking to the bus stop together, went to the cinema, and slept together once. He remembers her pierced tongue, and the hoarse laugh he found so attractive. A sudden lump of discomfort makes it hard for him to breathe, and he knows that if he hadn't taken a Mogadon earlier, his hands would be shaking, and he wouldn't be able to hide how upset he is. I think I've seen her, too, at the gym. This feels a bit creepy, he says, and tries to smile at Margot.
Which gym do you go to?
Adam asks, taking out a notebook.
Psats on Mr. Samuelsgatan, he replies, and swallows hard, but the lump of anxiety keeps growing.
Adam looks at him with a blank expression.
And you'd seen her there?
He says, pointing at the picture of Maria Carlson. I've got a good memory for faces, Eric says hollowly.
It's a small world, Margot says, without taking her eyes off him. Have you met Susanna Kern as well?
Adam asks, reaching for the last photograph.
No, Eric laughs.
But when Adam turns the picture, he's sure he's seen her before, somewhere. He doesn't know where. The name Susanna Kern meant nothing to him when he heard it, but he recognizes her face. Eric shakes his head and tries to make sense of this. He was brought in to talk to her husband after her murder. He hypnotized Björn Kern and went with him into his memories of the blood-soaked villa, but he never saw a picture of her.
Are you sure? Adam says, holding up the photograph.
Yes, Eric replies. The picture of Susanna smiling folds back over Adam's hand. Eric takes it and looks at her face, then shakes his head as his mind races and the room shrinks around him. He realizes that he's on the verge of a panic attack. His mouth is getting drier, and he slowly puts both hands on his lap to stop them shaking.
Tell me about the perpetrator profile, Eric says in a voice that sounds like it belongs to someone else.
He forces himself to sit still while they explain that the evidence suggests that the perpetrator is divorced with a relatively high socioeconomic status. He tries to concentrate on what they're saying, but his heart is pounding and thoughts are racing through his head in an attempt to find some sort of pattern, some sort of sense. How is this possible? He asks himself, trying to see any kind of system in this. He had a brief affair with Maria Carlson. Sandra Lundgren was his patient, and he knows he's met Susanna Kern. Three pictures of three women he's met. It's like a recurring dream. He can't work out what it is that he recognizes in this terrible situation. Across the table, Margot picks up her ringing mobile. Adam stands and walks over to the window. Someone's left a coffee cup on the windowsill. Suddenly, Eric realizes that the feeling of similarity is to do with Rocky. During hypnosis, Rocky described how the unclean preacher had shown pictures of Tina and Rebecca. Rocky had blamed himself, bellowing with pain and repeating words from the Bible. I should pluck out my eye, for it has offended me. And now he's lied to the police again. It felt impossible to say that he'd met all three of them. When Eric feels he can control his voice and body, he stands up. I have to go. I've got an appointment with a patient now, he says quietly. When can you next talk to Rocky? Margot asks, looking at him. Tomorrow, I think.
Don't forget the pictures, Adam reminds him, passing them to him.
As Eric reaches out his hand to take the photographs from Adam, he sways slightly, as it strikes him that he's a mirror image of Rocky. Damnation brushes past him like a wind presaging a storm,
and for a moment he sees himself gazing out through the 6-meter-high fence surrounding the exercise yard at Karsuddin. Chapter 70. Yuna is practicing his knife techniques, his fist and elbow exercises, as well as skipping, weight training, and running. He's still a long way from his old level, but is getting stronger all the time. His hip ached after his 5-kilometer run, and he walked the last bit. It's 7 o'clock when he sees Eric's BMW turn into the drive. Yuna puts the meat in the oven and pours 2 glasses of Pomerol as he hears the front door close and the sound of keys being put down on the chest of drawers. Yuna takes the glasses and goes to the library, pushes the door open with his foot and walks in. Eric's jacket is lying on the floor. He is in his study, searching through the papers on his desk. "Food will be ready in 40 minutes," Yuna says. "Great," Eric murmurs, glancing up with a stressed look in his eyes. "You've shaved. Nice. It felt like it was time." "How are you?" Eric asks, switching his computer on. "Good," Yuna says, walking into the room. "How's your hip?" Eric says, looking at the screen. "I've done some exercise, and I'm..." "Can we talk?" Eric interrupts, looking Yuna in the eye. "I've just had a meeting with Margot and Adam, and I'm not prone to paranoia, but I've met all 3 victims. It's crazy. I don't understand anything. But that can't be a coincidence, can it?"
"How do you know?
What are the chances of that?" Eric asks, staring at Yuna.
"How do you know the victims?"
Yuna prompts, and puts the glasses of wine down on the desk. "It feels like this is directed at me.
Maybe it's just my imagination, but if that is the case, then..."
"Sit down," Yuna says gently. "Sorry, I'm pretty shocked," Eric says, sinking down onto his chair and taking a deep breath.
"How do you know the victims?" Yuna repeats for the 3rd time.
"I had a brief fling with Maria Carlson earlier this summer. Sandra Lundgren was a patient at the clinic, and I recognize Susanna Kern. I've met her, but I don't know where."
"What does Margot say?"
"Well, I was so surprised that I didn't say anything about Susanna Kern, but I'm going to, obviously."
His mobile rings, making Eric jump.
"It's work. I'll leave it," he mutters, clicks to reject the call and drops his phone on the floor. "And I couldn't tell her I'd slept with Maria," he goes on, picking up his phone. "I just said we went to the same gym."
"Anything else?"
"I said that Sandra had been a patient of mine, but not..." "I still don't think this is relevant," he smiles, scratching his forehead. "I'll say it anyway. It's not unusual for patients to want to control the situation by trying to seduce their therapist. There's always a connection. That's only natural. But in this instance, the patient went so far that I passed her on to Nelly."
"But nothing happened between you?"
"No." Eric's hand is shaking as he picks up the wine glass, raises it to his lips, and takes several large gulps.
"Could it be a patient taking revenge on you for..."
"I no longer work with dangerous patients," Eric interrupts.
"But when you were doing research on..."
"That's 15 years ago, he says.
"How far back do your records go?"
"I record and archive everything."
"Can you go through it?"
"Only if I know what to look for.
Some sort of parallel, a connection, anything. Stalking, violence directed at the face, the arrangement of bodies, and we're probably dealing with trophies of some sort."
Eric is standing up now and starts walking back and forth across his study.
He runs his hand through his hair and is muttering to himself.
This is crazy. It's completely sick.
Sit down and tell me what...
I don't want to sit down,
Eric snaps.
I've got to listen,
Yuna says. You're welcome to stand, but I need to know as much as possible. And to be honest, you look like you need to sit down. Eric reaches for his glass, drinks on his feet, then pulls a pack of pills from his inside pocket, presses a couple out, and swallows them with some more wine.
Shit, he sighs.
Have you started on the pills again? I'd never have believed that, Yuna says, looking at him with sharp grey eyes.
I'm keeping an eye on it. It's fine.
Good. Eric sits down on his desk chair, wipes his forehead, and tries to breathe more calmly.
I can't get my thoughts together, he mutters.
I've been trying to work out if Rocky had an accomplice or an apprentice. You've only just seen him. Trying to uncover real memories is one of my areas of expertise. But hypnotizing Rocky was unusually complex. I managed to get past his organic amnesia and ended up in a world of heroin highs and delirium.
What happened?
I don't really know how to interpret it, Eric says in an unsteady voice. But today, when I was sitting there with Margot and Adam and realized that I'd met all three victims when I saw the photographs, I started to think back to the hypnosis again. This is completely sick.
I'm listening, Yuna says, sipping his wine.
Eric nods and screws his eyes up as he tries to describe what happened. Rocky was in a state of deep hypnosis when he said the preacher had shown him a picture of a woman he had already killed in front of his eyes. And after that, he showed him a picture of Rebecca Hanson. I could have sworn that was just a nightmare.
But it's the same killer, Yuna says. The preacher is back. It's the same pattern.
Eric's face has turned grey.
In that case, I'm playing Rocky's role this time, he whispers.
Did Rocky have relationships with the two women?
Yes.
Call Simone at once, Yuna says seriously. Eric picks up his phone, clears his throat, then stands up anxiously.
Simone, the familiar voice says in his ear.
Hi, Simone. It's Eric.
What's happened? You sound upset.
I need to ask you for a favor. Are Benjamin and John there?
Yes. But why do you...
I think I've got a patient who's stalking me. And I just don't want you and Benjamin to be on your own at home until this is sorted out.
What's happened?
I can't tell you.
Are you in danger?
I just don't want to take any risks. Please, just do as I say.
Okay, I'll try to bear it in mind, Simon says.
Promise!
You're scaring me, Eric.
Good,
he replies, and hears her laugh wearily. Chapter 71.
Eric has washed his face and is standing in the kitchen recounting everything Rocky said about the unclean preacher. That he wore makeup over his stubble, was a heroin addict, and showed him pictures while Yuna puts food on the table. He's roasted the lamb in the oven with root vegetables and garlic. He scatters some herbs over the dish, then pours more wine in their glasses.
This is great, Eric says, sitting down.
I just wanted to say, Suma's last months,
Yuna begins and looks up at him.
We had half a year together, the whole family. That wouldn't have been possible without you, Eric, without the medication you prescribed for her and everything. I knew I could trust you, and I'll never forget that.
They touch glasses, drink, and then chat about how they first met, but are soon back on the subject of Rocky and the photographs.
Margot needs to take the preacher seriously, Eric says.
She will, Yuna assures him. The profilers have come up with the I've seen it. I'm not involved in the case, obviously, but Anya told me that they've done a first sweep. She started with the parish of Salem, then nearby parishes and congregations, Yuna says, pushing the serving dish towards Eric. Roman Catholic, Assyrian, Russian, and Greek Orthodox, the Scientologists, Mission Church, Salvation Army, Jehovah's Witnesses, Latter-day Saints, Methodists, Pentecostalists. And now they're expanding the search to look at all the priests in the country that work with drug addicts, in prisons, institutions, and hospitals. Eric's hands have almost stopped shaking, but he's moving slowly as if he doesn't quite trust himself as he helps himself to food.
How many names are there on the list? He asks, pushing the dish towards Yuna.
More than 400 already. But if you can get Rocky to remember the preacher's name, a first name, a description, a parish, then it's just so difficult, Eric interrupts. His brain damage and addiction.
Why don't we talk about it tomorrow? Yuna says and starts to eat.
His memory follows its own patterns, Eric says, cutting his meat.
But he seems to remember much better under hypnosis.
Yes, although the door between nightmares and memory seems to be open.
But some of what he's told you has to be real memories, Yuna says.
It should all be real, in theory. It's just that it sounds psychotic, Eric points out.
If Rocky agrees to be hypnotized again, do it at once. Try to get hold of concrete details, like names and places.
I can do that. I know I can.
If you can, I'll be able to stop this serial killer, Yuna says.
I'll go down there first thing tomorrow morning, Eric says.
They eat in silence. The glazed root vegetables lend an earthy sweetness to the acidity of the red currant sauce. The salad is dressed with balsamic vinegar and truffle oil, the lamb spiced with coarsely ground black pepper and cut in slightly pink slices.
You really do look much better already, Eric says, as Yuna helps himself to more food. 6 injections of penicillin and a bit of cortisone.
He tails off when his mobile starts to ring in his pocket. He pulls it out and sees from the screen that it's Margot.
Yes, Eric here.
Is